Hey, I'm Mike Myers, and this is the Songwriting for Guitar podcast, which is geared to support songwriters and producers to gain confidence and turn pro. I bring on industry experts to help you improve and monetize your skills, engage better in the writing process, and build healthy habits to create a sustainable career that you love. Caffeinated, inspirational, conversational. Hey, what's up, friends? Mike Myers here with the Songwriting for Guitar podcast, episode 101 with John Lunn. It's very clear sometimes where I geek out about episodes when I have a guest on and I'm so excited to dive into it because I'm a fan of their work. And that's pretty much every episode. That's what's a great thing about having a podcast. But this one especially, John Lunn is a phenomenal composer. Things that he's done like Shetland, The Last Kingdom, a little show from Netflix, or the show called Downton Abbey. John is a phenomenal composer with an extensive background, not just in classical, but pop. And we dive into his entire process. How does he write to picture? How does he know what works for a scene? What is his process? And I'm so glad to have him on. He was so gracious enough with his time to speak to our Insiders Track Sync membership a while back that I was thrilled to have him back, dive deeper into the process. And so that's what this episode is all about. If you are someone that's trying to understand this world of composing and understand this world of TV and film, this is an episode you don't want to miss, and we get into it. So I'm not going to yammer on anymore. We're going to dive into it. Episode 101, John Lunn. John, I really appreciate you taking the time for this.
Well, it's my pleasure, Mike. Nice to be with you all again.
I was really excited because you spoke to my class a while back, and I just wanted to go into a deep dive conversation with you because I felt like there was so much more I wanted to cover and also just geek out over with you. And what better way on a podcast format? And, you know, even if people don't know who you are, they've heard your music. That's what I think is amazing about composing, is like they may be like, I'm not sure who you are, but immediately you say something like, oh, I think you said you'll take Downton Abbey to your grave. That's the thing that people will be like,
I'll be on my gravestone, you know, no doubt. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, things like that. But also most recently, I think, it, you know, with its success, Last Kingdom, which those two are just polar opposites to me.
Yeah, which was the attraction for me because I was becoming known for Downton Abbey. And actually, I quite, well, as you can see from behind me, I do quite like working with electronics as well. So Downton Abbey was a little bit of a, I wouldn't say it was an offshoot because I've always done orchestral stuff as well. But, you know, I was becoming known for that kind of sound, you know, that, and I was getting a little bit typecast. So when The Last Kingdom came along, I was really keen to do it because I knew it would be radically different, you know. And yeah, I mean, they couldn't be further apart.
I mean, especially because Last Kingdom, that's like 9th century area, so it's just like, what is this? You have kind of this, I feel like this leeway to be like, I can kind of create the sound that I want.
Well, you can, but you've got complete freedom because I mean, well, you know, our knowledge of what the music was like in the 9th century is pretty crude. And, you know, it's unlikely to be anything else other than what we think. And, you know, and that's not really the role of film music. You know, film music is an artificial genre that grew 100 years ago.
Yeah.
Basically. In the early, you know, forms of film music were like quite 19th century classical music, you know, and kind of over romanticized and over dramatic in many ways, you know. And we've kind of moved on quite a lot from that. A lot of what I do, I think, is about signaling what's going on inside people's heads in a movie, you know, the things that people don't say or but they're thinking. And that's certainly, there was quite a lot of that going on in The Last Kingdom. And there's a lot of that going on in Downton Abbey as well. And unless, you know, about tunes and, you know, taking you from A to B, and it's kind of all, you know, it's setting up and certainly in The Last Kingdom, there was the setting up a kind of constant atmosphere of dread a lot of the time, because it was, you know, people didn't live for very long, you know, it was brutal, you know, in many ways, you know, and then there are these kind of extreme moments of love and happiness, you know, so I really concentrated in those two extremes. And if you think about it, the music does move from those kind of, you know, beauty to kind of really raw, kind of quite ugly. And we use a lot of noise.
That's what I think is interesting. You went very synth-based.
Yeah.
I think if you look at something like, I still love the show, like Viking, like a lot of those other shows that popped up, very orchestral, hybrid orchestral kind of like realm, you chose, let's kind of not go into that, but let's do beds of sound. Almost what you said, because there's these tensions and release where it's a moment of like, they're secretly, they have a romantic moment, and the next minute you've got a massive battle where thousands are being killed.
Yeah. So instead of doing it with kind of like 19th century harmony, the tension between that, it uses a lot of noise, and there's a lot of detuning going on as well, and it's the tension's kind of created that way. And also at the time when we were started out on The Last Kingdom, there was a little bit of a worry about comparing it to Game of Thrones, although it's not remotely the same kind of show, because it's kind of based on fact, you know, roughly. Mm-hmm. And, you know, there's no sort of magic elements, you know, and it's not fantasy. I thought one way to not, you know, would be not to have that kind of sort of cod orchestral kind of element to it, and actually do it, you know, with something, you know, much more, much braver in a way, actually, I think. And the producers were, it was one of those jobs that just worked out quite well, in that I was due to take a break anyway, and they were still filming The Last Kingdom. So I had a little bit of time, you know, they sent me some clips and stuff like that, which is unusual for me. Usually I wait until the film's locked before I start working on it, you know, and it's been edited. But in The Last Kingdom, I actually started off quite early on it, you know, long before they'd locked the first episode, you know, and I had Ivar, the singer, on board as well before we'd locked, you know. I'd already brought her over from Copenhagen to London, and we'd had 3 days recording, and I knew then that, you know, that we were going to be doing it together.
The mixture of your sound beds that you create with her vocal, it's almost like it just works so well that now creates this thing that it's a signature sound to the show.
Yeah. So as I said, you know, we decided not to go down the orchestral route, and it was going to be all electronic. But I mean, that was easier said than done. I mean, there were, you know, because of these battles, you know, and these come, you know, sort of epic, you know, moments, you know, and, you know, how the hell am I going to do those, you know, without, you know, just with electronics? And I thought, at one point I managed to convince myself it was going to be possible. And then my agent played me a recording of Ivar on YouTube, and she was doing this throat singing, but kind of rhythmic and, you know, and kind of quite funky. And she was playing a drum as well. And I thought, ooh, God, that's interesting. In fact, what happened was I nicked the bit of YouTube of her, and I put it over the end of the very first episode. And then I added like a distorted double bass to it, and like a synth pad, basically. Mm-hmm. And I sent it off to the producers, and they absolutely loved it. So I got in touch with her, and brought her over to London, and we recorded for 3 days, and we did loads of different stuff. I mean, she did, because I really didn't know what to expect. I knew she did that rhythmic thing, and she was obviously a good singer, but she was also really kind of trying to be a pop artist at this stage. you know, in 2015, 2016. So I really wasn't sure what she was, but, you know, I mean, she's like a one-woman orchestra. You know, she can do everything. I mean, it's just, you know, I mean, she can be like a child sometimes. Sometimes we've used her like an English choir boy, you know, and then she does this kind of, you know, screaming banshee stuff that just sounds as come from, you know, some other side of hell that we don't even know of yet, you know, kind of sort of.
She's like a plug-in. It's almost like when you switch between modes and you're just like, oh, I want this. Oh. And you're just like modulating.
Yeah.
That's insane. Yeah. But that is it's that combo that became the sound.
Yeah.
And to me, it's interesting how you're talking about getting into the emotional head of the viewer. And to me, writing, you know, this side of composing, I think of it as just like how you write for songs too, because it's like when you write a song, like if somebody with just their guitar and vocal, they're trying to get into the head of the listener and connect with them. You're trying to connect what they're seeing on picture and to give a sonic representation of that emotion and to amplify it even more.
Yeah, writing a song and writing film music are kind of slightly different things, but and that was the interesting thing for both Ivor and I, was that I was having to come at it from her point of view, who was basically a singer-songwriter, and she was having to come at it from my point of view, in that she was, you know, instead of reacting to like chords or feelings or something, I was making her react to picture as well. So she had to learn how to react to emotionally to picture. And that was quite an interesting exercise in itself. And she got very, very good at that. And we had to kind of develop a language where I'd kind of imply what kind of thing we needed here, because, you know, you couldn't write down what Ivor did. There was absolutely no point in writing the music down. You know, why would you? You don't need her. You know, she's such a great improviser. And how the hell could you write half of it down anyway? You know, it's impossible. So nothing. There was not a note of music was ever written down in The Last Kingdom. It was all performed. It was all performed basically both by me and Ivor. And then we had a couple of percussion sessions. And then in season three, I badly needed an assistant. I needed a bit of technical help with all this stuff behind me. So I got my assistant. I got an assistant who was great, actually, and turned out. And in fact, Danny ended up doing, you know, a lot of season four and a lot of season five. And then he became a kind of colleague, really. So the three of us ended up doing the movie. Well, when we came to do the soundtrack album, that's when I realized that actually a lot of what Ivor and I had been doing was kind of like song material. So, and also because she was an artist in her own right, we decided to, for the soundtrack album, not to take, you know, the cues exactly as they were in the show, but to actually take the material and really turn them into songs. And that's what we've done in the last two albums. So on both the albums, there's stuff you'll hear that never appeared in the show.
What I find brilliant is you said that she came at from an angle of like, oh, I have to learn this new skill of learning, you know, for TV and film, and kind of invoking and understanding that. You came at it from like, I need to understand a little bit of hip. Both of you were kind of stretched a little bit out of your comfort zone, but it produced something that was really amazing that worked well. And I think it's a testament to the idea of sometimes pulling yourself out of that comfort zone to see what can you do and how could you create this differently and how could this build a new skill set for you?
Yeah. No, definitely. Definitely. That's good for everybody all around.
Yeah.
I think. And funnily enough, I think for Ivor herself, I made her confront her past in a way, you know, because she grew up as a kid singing this kind of stuff, you know, and then, you know, because she's from the Faroe Isles, although she now lives in Copenhagen. But she was kind of trying to be a pop artist, now, you know, and in some ways she probably still is. But now she, her gig, her live gigs, she does music from The Last Kingdom now as well, as part of it. So she's kind of I mean, it's a bit much for me to say that, you know, I helped her rediscover herself, because she's more than capable of doing that herself. But I think it showed her that what, you know, she'd learned as a kid growing up, that kind of way of singing, was actually incredibly valuable in what she was doing herself. So she's kind of incorporated that back more into her own music, really. And we've become really good friends, and stayed really good friends, actually.
What I hear from that is it's almost, again, like co-writing. You just set the ground for her to kind of live into that space, and like, oh, this thing that I thought, like, I'm not going to do that much anymore. You helped re-engage that. You just presented the ground, that space for her to go there. And I think that's the sign of a good co-writer.
Yeah. I mean, we did work incredibly well together. And in fact, occasionally she would send me stuff that she just thought of, and which I'm really not used to doing. I'm really used to creating the groundwork and then maybe letting somebody else kind of, I don't think I've ever before actually had the groundwork given to me and then for me to kind of embellish it on top. And that was quite an interesting, you know, feature as well. It was a really, really good learning exercise for me. And also, you know, composing can be quite a solitary thing, actually. And although we ended up doing quite a lot of it remotely, you know, it's good having somebody to feed back off and, you know, and just ponder with. You know, I mean, it's good. I do, you know, I like collaborating.
You know, this leads to the question, what got you into film and TV, especially composing? How did you get into this road? Because I know it's not a straightforward just, oh, I just went on composing. I went down the door, down the street, knocked on the door, and here I am. But like, it's a lot of twists and turns.
Well, I studied music at university, but then I came down to London. I got a publishing contract with a pop music label in London. That brought me down to London. And then for a while, in my 20s, I was in two worlds. I was in the kind of classical contemporary world, and I was also in the pop world as well, to kind of try and it was a bit of a clash. And then I was in this band that was quite famous in Britain and Europe in the 80s, but we were quite experimental. And the music we were doing was quite complicated, so we didn't have much visually to look at, right? In fact, there was one, the New Musical Express once gave us a review. Actually, they were raving about the music, but said we had the stage presence of a stepladder, right? So, which was probably true, actually. And so one of the things we did do is we got involved with contemporary dance companies. So we'd write music, you know, with them, and we started doing these shows with contemporary dancers. And anyway, eventually the band split up, but I carried on working with the dance companies, and I did discover that I did like writing music that had some kind of programmatic storyline element to it. And I found that I could do that, and it came quite naturally to me. And then when I was about 31 or 32, you know, I was in London. There was lots of connections. I was working in, not so much in media, but there was, with the dance world, there was quite a lot of producers and directors kind of involved in theatre and stuff like that. And you know, I just, somebody asked me to do a music for a TV series, and they just fired somebody, and you know, could I step in at the last moment? I did, and as soon as I did it, I knew, right, okay, that's it, that's what I want to do. I probably wasn't, you know, I was probably 31 or 32 by then, but I had 10 years in London performing just about every style of music, you know, from jazz to pop to contemporary classical, opera, you name it, because that's kind of what you have to do. You know, you don't, you know, every, you know, I'm doing stuff from Downton Abbey to Last Kingdom, you know, within sometimes, you know, both at the same time.
That switching, you know, the brain switching gears from being in that, you know, if you take things like Downton Abbey and things you've done like Grantchester, Shetland, and then you move over to suddenly, boom, you know, that is a huge shift to think of, like, how are you going to pull these melodies or the sound beds that you're creating? They're all vastly different.
Yeah. In fact, I've just moved on from, we just finished Shetland about 2 weeks ago, and I'm already on to Grantchester.
Oh. So, okay.
On the new series of Shetland is really good. Yeah, you probably are not out.
No, it's not. We're still waiting. Because when I interviewed you, I was like, I wanted to do a deeper dive, and I was like, oh, Shetland. I was like, well, we'll watch. We binged the entire series, but I also loved some of the, you know, again, the sound beds you create. I was like, because in my mind, I'm kind of like comparing them. I'm like, okay, here's the Downton Abbey realm, here's the Last Kingdom realm, here's the Shetland realm. And I'm like, okay, it's just like there's a little organic, but then I hear some like tension and release of, and then some building of like synth pulses, but then I hear drums and I hear some pulses. Again, it's like, you know, that feels like a heartbeat to me. This is a scene. I can understand why you're like, you have to be versed in many different shot. You can't just, if you're in one lane, everything's going to lean towards this direction. You've got to be able to pull from a couple different genres so that you can create those different feels and those different scenes, because the pacing's different in every show. It's different. I guess my next question would be, because, well, there's so many questions I want to get into, but it's interesting that you say you had a pop background, because part of me is like, you know, I can hear some of that in the melodies. I can hear some of that in, but it's done in a way that if you didn't say like I had a pop background, somebody would be like, oh, okay, you just know how to write good melodies. But it's like, that has to help when you're coming into writing a hook or looking like, oh, here's my moment where I will have a melodic hook that's very front and center. It needs, like, when you hear it, you go, oh, it's this show. Like, it's immediately.
Yeah, I mean, definitely. You know, I mean, like the, you know, the theme for Shetland's kind of like a song. You know, it's got those phrases, you know, that just, that kind of answer one another, really. It is a bit like a song, that one. Downton's slightly different, I think, in that, you know, all the elements kind of sort of mesh together. They're kind of more like, it's more like a modular thing, really, rather than a, you know, a sort of song with accompaniment. Although, to be honest with you, Downton has got the veneer of classical music, but actually it's got the harmony of a pop. I mean, the title theme could be a Coldplay song.
That's what's amazing about it. Yeah, you're very upfront about it.
Yeah, you know, it goes, you know, A minor, F major, A minor, F major, G major over F. And E, well, it's kind of like a it's got like a fourth chord on E, and then it ends on a C major 7. That's it.
I love that, because I think that's a great testament to, you know, maybe people think like they try to overcomplicate things because they think overcomplicating will make it interesting.
Not necessarily.
Yes, right there. Has that always been your motto too when it comes to composing?
I'm not sure that it's become my motto, but it's become obvious as I've worked in film that level of simplicity is what makes it work, because you're competing with other things, you know, in film. You're competing with dialogue and visuals and sound effects as well, and all of those are contributing to the meaning that's going on as well. So you have to find your, you know, your own space within that and interact with it. And you can only really do that, you know, when the music's really obvious and really, really simple. But that can take time. You know, people think, you know, that, you know, I mean, Downton Abbey theme tune is incredibly simple. You know, it really is very simple. But it took 3 weeks. It took me 3 weeks to write it. You know, so what, you know, does that make it simple? Or does that mean, you know, it's all white notes.
this just gets into me the interesting realm of composing, whether you're doing it for film, TV, songwriting. It's all about connection. It's about enhance. If you're writing a song, it's about working with your melody, your lyrics, enhancing the feeling. When you're writing for film and TV, it's enhance all those things that you talked about, the visuals, the dialogue, what is happening, and finding your place in there to enhance all of that and not fight it and not deter or make somebody go like, I was paying attention, but what the hell are they doing here? It's not going to work then. But sometimes it is a while to get there because it's that balance. Sometimes simple can be the hardest thing to find because you'll want to overcomplicate it. But it's just, I feel even when I'm mixing something or working on arrangement, it's always I'm eliminating things. I'm like taking things away because I'm like, oh, I take it away and I don't miss it. Like it wasn't adding anything other than me being like, oh, it needed to be there.
Yeah, I mean, you know, obviously when you say simple, you know, you kind of, I mean, that can mean a multitude of things.
Yeah.
A lot of what I do is still, you know, very instinctual. I watch the scene over and over again, and I improvise to the scene. And I think one thing that makes a composer is that ability to, when you have played something, is to recognize that you've actually created something. There's something in there that makes you go, oh, what was that? What did I just do there? You know, and it's that ability to recognize that and then take it on board and develop it. I think that's why I spend a lot of time improvising to the picture. I very rarely improvise away from looking at the picture because I end up making it too complicated. You know, music just on its own, to me, sometimes you can overcomplicate things. So I'm constantly looking at the scene in front of me. I'm playing it over and backwards and forwards again, and sometimes I can spend days not getting anywhere. You know, and then suddenly some spark will happen, and then you just, but it's having that ability, experience almost as well, of being able to hone in on what it was that gave you that little spark. And that's what I'm looking for, you know, all the time, really. I've been doing a little bit of teaching, I mean, a tiny little bit, and I've been doing a little bit of mentoring, and which I have been find interesting because it does confront what you do. You know, I think that what I do is kind of constantly instinctive, but actually, you know, reasons for a lot of it that I just hadn't really explained to myself. And then when you're having to teach somebody about it, is you have to step back and think, right, okay, why have I done that? And oh, I see, that's why I do that. But one thing with all my students, and it's difficult for them because usually there are time constraints on the things that we're going to do, but by and large, absolutely all of them are too happy to go with the first thing that comes into their head. Now, sometimes that can be right. I mean, occasionally, but not enough of them. And then what will happen is we'll spend quite a lot of time trying to mold that very initial material into something meaningful, you know, whereas actually, you know, the first idea really wasn't that good. The second idea wasn't really that good. You know, the third idea, no, maybe not. The fourth idea, fuck, yeah, great.
That's,
you know,
the thing.
You know, that's yeah. And then suddenly you're away. You don't spend all that time trying to mangle something that, you know, that wasn't there into something, you know, that me. So I'm quite often will rip things up and start again.
I love ripping things. I love just because I think it challenges you to, it's like if, you know, we sat down and wrote a song, it's just like, okay, that chorus isn't bad. Can we write a better chorus? We probably can if we do it again. Cool. Let's push ourselves and write another chorus. We probably can write a better chorus. It just pushes the realm of just when you think there's something that was pretty good, there's probably something better. If you do it again and repeat the process and refine it a little bit and do it again, Because you're right. It's hard to take something, maybe the first draft, and try to make it meaningful when the whole point of the first draft was just to give you practice. It's kind of hard to make that deep and like make it work when it's just like, oh, the point of that was just to give yourself some footing and just play around.
And it is hard in a teaching sense as well, because you're kind of time constraints on the students as well. Like when I first do a TV series, for instance, the first thing I'll look at is the schedule. And I always want, I want as much time in episode one as possible. Because if I get episode one right, then episodes 2 to 10 are going to fall into place. You know, if I don't get episode one right, and it's a bit of a struggle time-wise, it's just going to lead to problems further down the line. You know, so I usually try and ask for like 6 weeks for the first episode, and then if the next ones are every 2 weeks, that'll be fine. You know, it's just making sure that your material is really strong. You know, and if you look at Downton Abbey, all that, most of the material, even to the last movie, you know, much of the material was created in the very, very first episode. And it's the same with The Last Kingdom. You know, most of the material comes from the very first episode.
That, to me, is also insight into how much thought you give to that, because you're thinking long term when you think to that first episode, because you're thinking, this is going to paint the story arc going forward. This is going to be the continual sound, because it can't be something that just, you know, 1 minute sounds like this, the next episode is like, and then it's like, what the hell? It changed dramatically. It's like there has to be some consistency long term with the whole thing.
I mean, a lot of what I'm doing is kind of unifying it, and Downton, a lot of the music's about the relationships between characters, really, rather than individual characters. But if you look at that opening theme, it's got like four main elements to it. It's got the dan 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 dan, the main sort of solo piano tune. It's got this rising thing, string tune, da 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 dee da 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 dee da da, which is much more sort of emotive, and it's got this kind of very repetitive sort of piano, and then there's this sort of more expansive chord change at the end, which is much more kind of pompous. It's got like a dominant seventh, but in the fourth inversion. And all those four elements, they can work together as one, but each one of them on their own can be something else as well. So, for instance, you can do a really slow version of the da da dee da dee da da da. You can do it, you know, just on its own with, you know, a different harmony underneath. In fact, I did do that as well. And then the rising string tune, again, with different harmony underneath, it's still that tune, but it can take on an even more tragic meaning. You know, I ended up developing that tune for some of the more tragic moments, you know, in the TV series. It's all kind of interlocking like that. And so the material's kind of, especially in Downton, the material's quite modular in that there's lots of different elements going on, but they can all be used separately, but they can also be used together as well.
Hey, it's Mike, and I just wanted to jump in the middle of this episode. And if you're listening and you're getting excited about writing for TV and film, and you're like, I would love to do this, but how do I know what's working? What should I be writing? I'm so confused. It's all over the place. That's why you need to be a part of our Insiders Track membership. It's all about helping you understand what's working for TV and film so you can start writing the right type of songs, the songs that actually start working for TV and film, start working for the scene, so that when you see these opportunities pop up, submit this song for licensing, get to meet this supervisor, get to meet, you don't have to question and wonder, are my songs working? You've put in the time and you've been a part of a community that helps you shape and craft the songs that do work for TV and film. So what I want you to do right now is go to insiders-track.com www.thefilmmusic.com or just click the link in our description and sign up. You're going to get, right now, listeners of this podcast are going to get a $100 discount for a full year's access to our membership. You can start joining our lives. You could start diving into past sessions, past guest sessions, and you can start joining for future guest sessions. So when all those opportunities pop up, guess what? You don't have to wonder. You don't have to question. You've got the songs ready. So remember, just go to insiders-track.com and start creating songs that work for TV and film. What I love is you were singing out parts. And for me, sometimes it's like when I know something feels right, I can kind of sing it out before I play it. Or if I'm playing something, I'm singing out the next thing and I'm like, oh, that'd be cool. It's almost like they're, again, they intertwine, they work together, yet they're very strong independently. And that could be another version. And I just, I don't know. I just love the idea sometimes of like saying it before you play it, to just like, you know, just because it runs through your head and you can hear things.
Well, when I'm improvising, you know, I'm not just playing the piano and stuff. I'm also singing away to myself. I mean, God knows what it sounds must sound like at times, but luckily nobody's usually listening to me anyway, so it's fine.
there should be an alternative version where it's just an album of you just sing out the parts and just blend them together. I think that, to me, saying before you play it is always just a great rule of thumb, because we talked about this when you were with my class, but like why I love things, because when people look at me, they assume like it's just nothing but punk rock that I listen to, and I'm like, no, it's just like, but we talked about, I think the beauty of someone like a composer like Bach is I can sit there and I could sing you, you know, Sheep May Safely Graze. I could sing you the melody of, you know, Sleeper's Wake. I could sing you, you know, Minuet in G, because I'm like, damn, Bach was basically like a pop songwriter. Like he was like during that time, I'm like, he was a pop songwriter. He's writing all these melodies, counter melodies that just intertwine and they're so strong independently, but how they weave together.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Chopin definitely like that.
Yeah.
Chopin was an improviser, basically. I mean, he's kind of, he's probably like he was a pop musician of his own era, really.
I think recognizing that, you know, it's like pop music isn't something it's kind of slowly, it just looked different. They just had wigs and they had harpsichords and they had, and it was like, but that was like a modern day pop where everybody went. And I thought the power of their melodies are, there was no way that an audience could take that with them. They couldn't throw on their iPod. They couldn't throw on their phone. It was just the moment of being present and hearing their melody. But how many of them took away a moment?
I mean, the amalgamation of, you know, things like, you know, Chopin and Wagner, but the amalgamation with black music, you know, or 120 years ago. I mean, that's a massive change. You know, the last 120 years in music is all about the influence of black music. You know, it's completely transformed it. It's completely it's almost turned music on its head, basically. And, you know, that combination has created a whole other, you know, amazing genre, really, you know. I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, I'm really, I've always been a big fan of Duke Ellington. And I thought I knew his music really well. But recently I was looking at a book, and it's just, it's one of those, you know, sheet music books where it's just a tune and there's a chord kind of chart underneath. And it's really made me think about what he does. I mean, the harmony is just so extraordinary. But, you know, doing that, you know, some of the stuff he did 100 years ago. And it's really made me think about it. I'm playing the tune with my right hand, but I'm having to think all the time about the harmony. I've learned so much. You know, and I'm in my 60s. I'm thinking to myself, why didn't I do this, you know, 40 years ago? You know, because it's an extraordinary learning experience.
Now, something I just don't want to skip over that I think is awesome about that, and I think it's, you're constantly looking for ways to just be amazed by music and just like taken aback a little bit and deconstructing something or looking at it and being like, well, this is just changing the game of how I view things now. Like it's just another piece of knowledge where I feel like sometimes people think, oh, when you get a degree or if you just do this, that's where the learning ends. And I'm like, it's actually just where it begins.
Oh, God, no.
What you're describing is...
No, I'm constantly learning all the time. Yeah, I mean, even, you know, with all this electronic stuff at the back as well, I'm constantly learning. I mean, music's an incredible thing, really, you know, when you think about it. All the incredible stuff that people have done, you know, some of it written down, a lot of it not remotely written down. You know, I mean, it's extraordinary. I mean, James Brown, that early funk stuff, to turn a dominant seventh into a tonic, you know, not even Wagner managed that. You know, that's that's astonishing, really, you know. I mean, obviously, you know, as I get older, there is some, you know, styles of music that do take me a while to kind of, you know, broach and kind of, you know, get into. And, that I don't spend much time, you know, I'm not in clubs all the time trying to work out, you know.
Yeah.
But in fact, one of my wife's cousins from Australia came over and stayed with us for about 2 or 3 weeks. And he's trying to be like a full-time DJ, and I've got no idea what that means. You know, what does that mean?
Yeah, it's a completely different world.
Play records?
Yeah.
Do you just play records to people? Or, I mean, what?
Some are a stretch, but it's interesting that, yeah, it's just, you're still looking for ways to just get inspired or things take you aback. And it's just, that is the power of music, that it can make a connection that, especially in this realm of composing, when someone hears it's an interesting question to ask, what's the feeling of this is leading to something that feels questionable, that no matter what language you may have, that chord or that sound that you're creating makes it feel like something's coming, or it's just like, oh, that was a dodgy question, that was something that was weird. There's something beautiful about composing in that way.
It constantly surprises me. And I, you know, I've done so much now. I must have done over 100 different, you know, projects. Although I must admit, as I get older, the pressure, because everybody wants a piece of genius for their show. And that's pretty pressurizing, you know, all the time. Eventually you kind of think, oh, you know, God, have I really got the energy to do it? But something funny that happens when you put the episode up in the scene and you start to play with it and you think, all right, okay. And then, so I'm kind of addicted to it. You know, I'll miss it when I don't do it.
That to me is also when you know you've kind of sparked. There's a book I love, it's called The Big Leap, and it's by Gay Hendricks, and he talks about the zone of genius. What's the thing that makes you feel like totally on fire? And what you're describing right there is like, you wonder like, do I have it in me to just do it again? But then you start the process again. You go, oh, this is why I do it. It's almost like it takes you back to that first time that you composed and you were like, well, this is it. This is the thing that I'm doing because it's
Well, that's kind of part of the addiction, is that, you know, there's incredible pressure to do it then. But then the payoff, once you've done it, you know, is so massive, and everybody, particularly, you know, within a film, because, you know, you're not entirely on your own. You are working with other people, and that is, you know, very much a collaboration with, you know, producer and director. But once you've done something that really works and really makes a difference to it, you know, everybody's really appreciative, and it's that kind of buzz that you get off it. I think that I would really miss that. Despite that, every time I come to a new project thinking, you know, oh my God, how am I going to bring this one off, you know, or, you know, this is the one I'm going to be found out on, you know, kind of, you know. But because, you know, amazingly, I still have moments like that, you know. I still have days where I write complete rubbish, and that's hard, you know, to get to spend a couple of days, especially with some of the schedules we have now, you know, spending a couple of days and not having anything to show for it is quite tough.
There's an assumption where people think, well, oh, if you've done all this, now it's just you sit down and everything's gold. Like, you're just like,
yeah.
But the idea of knowing like, oh, you've got several days where you feel like, shit, this isn't it.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because there's some people that get to that point in their writing, their composing, and they go, this isn't it. I guess I'm not meant to do it. And then they leave. But there are others that go, this shit, well, I got to push through and eventually I'm going to get to where it needs to be. But there's just this weird, awkward moment of just like, just the slow trudge to finding what is the thing as opposed to just bailing.
And then it can be even harder after you've had something really successful. You know, everybody thinks, oh, well, you know, that, you know, they're expecting something, you know, along the same lines. And actually, without realizing just what hard work it was to come up with a, you know, with a first thing in, you know, in itself. I suppose what we're trying to say is, in the long run, is that although you might have had a, you know, a serious degree of success in what we're trying to do, we're basically still much in the same state as we were, you know, a student in our early 20s, you know, really, you know, it's still thinking, yeah. Oh God, I mean, how am I going to do this? You know, I'm really there, you know, I'm not thinking, you know, I'm John Lennon, I've done Downton Abbey, this is going to be a doddle, you know, I mean, yeah. You know, it's not like that at all, you know, in some, in many ways, my, you know, my psychological well-being hasn't moved on in the last 40 years. And then, you know, and that's maybe, that's possibly a good thing. You know, I think it's possible to get too, you know, too over yourself and too, and think that you really are a genius and that actually, who was it said? I think it was a golfer, actually, said, the harder I practice, the luckier I get. But somebody accused him of being lucky or something. I can't remember. And that's right. He said, the harder I practice, the luckier I get. Which I think is a great phrase because, you know, I don't think there's any luck involved in writing music, really. Would you say? Is there luck? Is there such a thing as luck?
I don't think there's such a thing as luck. I think it's those that just stay with it, that are willing to be okay with the messiness of music at times. Because that's tough. It's a very uncomfortable thing to tell someone, like, you know, if I have a client or a student, I say, like, you're going to have to be okay with being uncomfortable for a while. It's not going to be good. Like, I have hard drives full of just shit. Like, and I've never shown this and I'm never going to show this to anyone.
Yeah.
But I'm okay with that because you know what's great? I look at that now and that was me learning and that was me performing at my best. That was me like really being like, this is good. And now I'm like, it was okay. But I stayed with it. And the only difference between someone doing it and not doing is they just stayed with it.
Yeah.
I think that's the key. And or being a perpetual student, how you're saying, like, still looking at someone else's work and being like, shit, that's amazing. And just, like, dissecting it and finding the gold and then just going back to their space and playing along. And just, it's a new thing that's integrated to their process.
Yeah, I think the perpetual student thing, I think, is a bit of a problem because that sort of implies that you don't, you know, you're always working on something and but you know, at some point you're going to have to give birth to it and present it to the outside world, you know, I mean, and as you know, the sooner you do that, the better, really. I mean, you can, you know, if you keep on thinking, because also I think that's also part of it, because you can't just use yourself as a benchmark in music. I think you have to use others as well. As it. So what you think might be brilliant, you know, the rest of the world could completely hate. I mean, it's not rare if that happens, to be honest, but, you know, it's entirely possible. So you do. So I'd be wary of the perpetual student syndrome, you know, and that, you know, I'm not going to release anything until I'm really, really happy with it. Yeah, I mean, I've kind of gone against what I've said myself. You know, you should work on your material till you're really, really happy with it. But somewhere in there, I'm kind of contradicting myself. But somewhere in there is a sort of truth, is that you are going to have to, you know, give it out to people to hear. I think I grew up with a couple of people who I thought were really good musicians. And I would describe them as perpetual students. They never really placed their neck on the block, and they were always full of potential, and they never ever realized it.
I think we know a lot. I know lots of people that are in the same boat that are fantastic, but they've never stepped beyond. They've never taken that first step of, and maybe it's just like, you know, my skin has gotten stronger over time to just like, cool, give me the feedback of what is not working. It's, you know, I feel that's where I'm at now. I don't mind hearing when something's working. I'm like, that's great. But I'm kind of interested in what's not working. Like, where is the hole in this? There's got to be something, because it's like, it's not the best. Like, it's okay. How can it get better? Because, yeah, you do want to work on it. And I agree. I think what you're saying is don't give the first thing, but by, you know, the 60th, 70th, 80th, you're
You
going to
got
have to
it.
eventually, you're going to have to get it out there. Because if you get that feedback, you can then go back and adjust, and you can, and the next thing you create is basically the knowledge that you gain from releasing and learning from it. And you realize, well, if I do that again, I'll get better, and I'll get better, as opposed to constantly revising it to it's perfect, where it's not going to be perfect. It's just going to be, it's it, in fact, to make it worse, because you may be taking some of the gold out of it that you don't know, because you never fully embraced actually showing someone it.
No, exactly. And, you know, and that can be hard, right? You know.
It's tough. It's super tough. It's a very vulnerable feeling to say to someone, tell me what's wrong. You know, did you have, especially growing, people that you kind of looked to that were doing the thing that you want to do, that were able to kind of guide you along? I'm sure there's lots of people that you can think of that, but is there someone that stuck out to you that kind of guided you, especially during as you developed in film?
No, there wasn't really, because I mean, there was nowhere you could go and study it. I mean, now there are, you know, there are hundreds of film courses all over the world now. No, there was nowhere. There's nobody. I guess I kind of, you know, I'd probably been watching lots of movies and just taking it all in. But yeah, no, I had to learn really quickly.
That's amazing. But I love the fact that you're also, and this is a sign of someone that I think is not just a great composer, but just like you're also taking that knowledge and helping others. Because it's one thing to be applied to the things that you do, but to help other people understand and navigate, I think is huge.
I do. I feel really strongly about that, because, as I said, there was nowhere, you know, I could go to study really what I was meant to do. And film music's, you know, changing, and it's changed over the years as well. And I think, and it's been good for me. You know, I learn quite a lot by doing a giving back. You know, but I'm getting to the end of my career now, so I think it's important for me to impart my experience to, you know, the next generation. I think that's just what I should be doing.
John, this was such a good conversation. I feel we could keep on going. It's like we haven't even
I
gotten into
cheers,
gear.
Mike.
I'm just like, I'm just like, it's like we could go into analog synths and just how they're amazing.
You
But
know, maybe we should do an analog synth one in 6 months' time.
I think we need to do an analog synth one, because I love, there's just something about it. We're in a world of plugins, which is amazing and wonderful, but there's something about being able to just like, I have off to the side my little sturdy, trusty, like Moog to the side that has always been my go-to for when it's like making something interesting and just like to put my hand on like modulation and just like do filter sweeps. It's just, I don't know, there's something about it that's different than just,
I mean, I hardly use any plugins. I mean, it's mainly all synths.
Yeah, that's another. We got it.
Yeah,
That's a whole
yeah.
other
Maybe we
episode
should
where we're
do
gonna have
another
to
one.
take it.
Yeah.
But John, I really appreciate you taking the time.
Pleasure, Mike.
And that does it for this week's episode. It was edited and produced by Chris Fafalius. And remember, if you're enjoying these episodes and you like the content that we're putting out, be sure to head to Apple Podcasts, leave us a 5-star review, talk about your favorite episode, and then share. Share an episode with a friend, because every little bit helps. Believe me, we wouldn't be here at 101 episodes without you. Until next week, I'm Mike Myers. Thanks for listening.